1982 Act 1982. some amendments, but Dr. Bassani would like to make sure that we can answer questions.
Thank you, honourable members, and thank you, DM, for giving us this opportunity to present the draft amendment to the Veterinary and Paraveterinary Professions Act 1982. Maybe to enter a registered facility with the purpose of inspecting that facility. I'm sure that members already know that in terms of veterinary practices, consulting rooms, these are actually registered by the council, by the veterinary council. But if there are complaints about a registered facility or there is a need to inspect that facility, we are providing for powers of officers to enter those premises and inspect them and satisfy them that the clients who are visiting that facility are getting excellent service from that facility itself. We are also ensuring that the persons and veterinary facilities registered by the council comply with the minimum standards provision. And provision is made for the appointment of officers to inspect the registered veterinary facilities and the powers they will have during an inspection. We are also providing that there should be adequate inspections. The council shall appoint an investigating officer. The president of the council must approve the application for a warrant from the judge or magistrate to search and seize records, electronic data relating to a complaint that is being investigated. And this will only be given if there is evidence of transgression of the act and reasonable belief that there is records and electronic data that are being hidden by the person who is to be investigated. And the details of the records and electronic data recorded beforehand, and a well-founded affirmation that the evidence may be hidden or destroyed or been tampered with by the person who's been investigated. We are also providing for the fact that any person who's aggrieved by a decision of the register, the president or council in terms of this section, has the right to appeal to the High Court against such a decision. Section 31B provides for new powers of the amendments and will provide for better control and provides for the functioning of the South African Veterinary Council with the South African Police Services, the National Prosecuting Authority, the Medicines Regulatory Authority, and then the National Societies for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the Health Professions Act, and the South African Pharmacy Act. This is also in the context of what has been happening in the country, as we all know the challenges that the country has been having related to the use of M99, a very dangerous drug that has been used in the poaching of rhinos, which has created a situation in the country. Section 33, the cost orders. We found that in our experience, when there is a hearing scheduled and the people who are supposed to come in for hearing, the ones who are accused in particular, tend to continuously postpone hearings because of unavailability, and the council didn't have any powers to do about to these people. And then we are trying to provide, we are requesting that provision be made for the cost orders to be implemented, or the cost to be transferred to the person who's unnecessarily postponing hearings. And then we believe that this will improve investigations and improve turnaround time. Section 33A, we are also providing for the right to appeal to the appeal committee if an affected person is not satisfied with the outcome of the inquiry body. Section 41, we are providing for penalties for people who fail to give or refuse access to an officer or an investigation officer who impersonates the registrar or an officer or an investigation officer, or who contravenes or fails to comply with the provisions of Section 32A. And then Section 43, which is again another proposed amendment, empowers the Council to recommend that regulations be drafted or amended to give effect to the investigation and or to inspections of the veterinary facilities. That is the end of the proposed amendments that we are tabling to honourable members. DM. But maybe my last slide should be on the process that we have undertaken up to so far with regards to the legality of the proposed amendments. We have consulted with the State Law Advice Office, and it has been advised that it is not necessary to take the bill through to the National House of Traditional Leaders in terms of Section 81A of the Traditional Leaders and Governance Framework Act 2003, since it does not contain provision pertaining to customary law or customs or traditional communities. But of course, honourable members will decide as to if they agree with the amendments, then how we will take the bill through. Maybe through UGM, commit that the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, together with the Council, if so desired, will participate in the public hearings and try to provide as much information as possible to the Chair and also to the honourable members. Maybe I should say one last thing here, that related to the amendments, related to the profession itself, without looking at the compulsory community service, extensive consultations with the profession had occurred, and there is none of the proposed amendments that has been viewed to be very contentious, unless there is another angle that I am not sure of. But again, consultations that have happened with the university has also been very extensive, and the students have been looking forward to performing this service. But we have also benchmarked with the Department of Health to see what were the challenges related to implementation of compulsory community service from the Health Department of Health point of view. With these few words, DM and Chair, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mulsani. I think it explains broadly the whole objectives of the Act as it is clause by clause. And as I said, the Veterinary Council is here as well, and it cooperates with them all the time. And at the moment, there's total agreement on that from their side as well. But if there's any questions, we should be happy to answer it.
Are you saying, Deputy Minister, that the Veterinary Council will also make an input?
They can if they want to. I'm not sure. Their choice. I don't want to speak on their behalf. I just said there was a lot of negotiations, and they agree broadly. That was as I perceived it when I negotiated with them. But if he wants to add, Dr. Moran is welcome. Yeah.
Thank you, Deputy Minister, Chairperson, honourable members. Process could be finalized so that we can really make sure that we promote access in the country.
mentioned, of course, as I said, these will, you know, come out of the actual text itself. And the detail, as I always say, the detail is in that, the devil is in that detail. Just two quick ones on my side, and as members are still, you know, perusing and digesting. Just a quick one on the actual, you know, timing of the implementation. Of course, you know, you shall also be following this with regulation that give effect, you know, to the law itself. And the other one that I was, you know, reminded of, especially as you are concluding, you know, with whether or not this will be taken to the, in our House of Traditional Leaders, perhaps from the legal section of the drafters, would be the tagging of the bill itself. You know, 77, 76, so that we are also clear going forward. We're not, you know, taken back after having moved, you know, some distance. Members? Welcome, Mr. Gila. I just trust we were not also disorganized with the change of time and the venue. I have apologized already on behalf of the Secretariat here. Times have been changing and venues have been changing. Sorry, I noted your hand, Mrs. Stein. Mrs. Palliser.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I think it's a well thought through presentation. We set out all the changes and amendments in a good way. Chair, I have a few questions. Firstly, the Dr. Morissard mentioned that one of the reasons why places that students after graduation find it difficult to find a job. What would be the main reasons for this, and what are we doing to make sure that after the 1 year they will then be able to find a job? Is there something in place? Because what we don't want is that after 1 year then they still don't find a job. How are we going to make sure that we look into that? Because I'm really worried about that. If we have a shortage of beds in South Africa and they still can't find a job, what is wrong? Why is it like that? Then, Chair, on under Section 12, the appeal for time frame for appeal to be lodged, I see there was a section saying within the specific or in the specified manner or something. What is the time frame? Is there a time frame that you must lodge it, and where and how do you find that? How will people know that? Then in Section 28(3), it says the minister may waive this in a prescribed manner. What would be the manner? When can this waiving take place? And under what circumstances? And will everyone know what it's about? And will there also be like a lodging if people are not happy, especially if they're placed somewhere where they're not happy? How will that process take place? And while we're on that, was there any discussions in this time with the students about that, and were their views taken into account? Because I understand that if this bill becomes an act, it won't happen next year but only the year after. So obviously I think, you know, the students that would be the first to go through this process, what was the consultation with them, and how do they feel about that, specifically about placement and the fact that they actually can lodge a complaint or not a complaint, a waiver of this. Then, Chairperson, the question on Section 24, there was something about graduates that's not able to pay after completion. what is the current status? Do we have bursaries? Do we have a lot of students that find it difficult to pay? Because I think we also need to look at the current situation. If we have a shortage of beds, what are we doing currently to ensure that we get enough people and the right people into universities? And then just for myself, under the investigating officer and the duties of that officer, what is happening currently? Who is fulfilling that role at the moment? What do we do? Do we have someone that go and look at the facilities and can investigate any cases at the facilities at the moment, or what is happening currently? And then just for myself, Chair, this physiological condition, psychological, physiological, it's a physiological, it's not a psychological. I've been on a very long research. English is not my first language now. I'm struggling with these nice words. Do they have training, and will this fall under the paraveterinary services? I didn't see a list of what is the paraveterinary. I think I know what veterinary is, but I don't know what is paraveterinary, and with that physiological condition then also falls under that. And then who would do the training? I mean, just because I'm a farmer's wife and I know about these scannings, and just everyone can come and do it. So where would the training of that go into, and who would be able to do that? And then the last one, Chair. When we place these students now wherever, who is going to look after them? Because when you go out on your own in these rural areas and you're still not sure, what system are we going to put in place to make sure that when they have a question, or they're not sure, or they need training or help or mentorship or whatever you want to call it, what is in place to do that? Do we have the people to do that? That's my last question at this stage. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everybody. Some of us were at the oversight, we're not in Cape Town, that's what we the department has indicated that the implementation of compulsory community services is part of the form, the MTS. Does this mean that the veterinary professionals who will be doing community service will be getting a salary or a stipend during these 12 months? If they will be paid a stipend instead of a salary, what is the rationale and what will stop them from pursuing other career options instead of practicing as veterinary professionals, considering that community service will give them an extra year?
Thank you.
have fish, Mediterranean? If there are, how many are there? If not, and with the exception of the use of private consultants, how is the department addressing the challenge?
Thank you, Chairperson. According to the advice that you received from the state law advisor, that it's not necessary for this group to go to the House of Traditional Leaders. But if you want to deal with the rural agriculture, you need to involve them. Now, have you taken them on board? Because it's very important to take them on board of this group, whether if it doesn't go through the house, but you need to take them on board, and that's where most of your problems are, in rural areas. Then the second one is you are saying here some of the students do not get their certificates because of non-payment of their fees. But don't they get bursaries? And you're also talking, you talk of universities. What about agriculture colleges and FET colleges? Is this bill going to accommodate them? Because we're sitting with a problem here, Chairperson, of having these youths going to these different colleges, sitting with the teachers and doing nothing, not getting any assistance or any work for that for that matter. Will this accommodate them? And how are they going to be accommodated? We've been talking about this for years. How will they be accommodated? Lastly, what plans have you got to retain skills in this country? Because it is quite true that most of your so-skilled people leave and go overseas. But have you got any plans to retain skills? And within your department, I've said that many, it's a question that's never been answered. Have you done a skills audit? In doing a skills audit that will tell you that next year, in the next 4 years, we will need so many vets, we will need so many that and that and that. That is what a skills audit is about. And then making sure that you get what you want from the FET college and universities. Thank you.
Let's take that first round.
Thank you, Chairman. If I got it correctly, there was 15 questions, so I ought to finish before that. Let me try and answer some that we're going to delegate to the different officials. First, I think the first question from your side was on the implementation. And I think the Honourable over there said it seems, depending it's now in almost August, it will not be possible next year. And hopefully the year after that. Students are ready, I'm told, and there has been consultation with them. They're willing even to do voluntary service next year to get into this. But at the moment, as you said, the bill, the Act will only give you some of the regulations are still being drawn up, the our policy documents. And I think it's important what Dr. Matsani said, that we try to learn from what happened in the health department with the medical doctors, because they also had a lot of problems in the beginning to really get the system working. And I'm now also answering as a parent with a daughter that went through that process. And the entity can be quite complicated. The husband is over here in Limpopo, the vets in Cape Town, the baby is in the middle of this situation, and that's some common sense to solve those type of problems. So in the end, the regulations will help you how to do that and how to be implemented by the department from their side. I'm just going to react to this. The second one also was about the process, 74-76. Now 74 deals with the change of the constitution, but that's not applicable. And 76 is if it in the end affects provinces in any sense, and advise at this moment it doesn't affect provinces in any sense, because if you look
young vets will need on a day-to-day basis. The second component that we needed a legislative infrastructure in order for us to be able to go ahead. So the state at which we are in now, we are presenting this bill with all these amendments, and as soon as it's approved and becomes official, it will then be supported by a range of regulations that we will also be taking some time, and they begin to give more input and more meat into the operational matters that the students, the stakeholders, and the honorable members have already alluded to. Issues related to mentoring, housing, and all those operational issues, they come in the next set of documents after we have got the legislative framework to support them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. If I go to the third one, it's the occupation of jobs, and we've got the problem, as I said, that we have a lack of state veterans. I was informed by Dr. Mulisani that for the first time now we get more applications once we start advertising for jobs in a certain sense. And the question from Spain is there an answer for after 1 year while the struggle? I think in this in a certain sense, and it also answers in a sense the whole question in the end about people leaving the country. We believe that, well, I won't use the compulsory, but is in a sense forcing people then to stay for 1 year, in a certain sense already helped to bridge that problem. Being here, even going to the rural areas, the whole idea is hopefully maybe we become committed there. I make a joke, or maybe he marries a farm girl over there or whatever and then stays in the rural areas. Or maybe see, even working as a state vet is not that bad, because sometimes there's a negative image about that, and hopefully that already will help. That's some of the experience we also had from the other side, from the health department, where that sort of process did happen. And then after 1 year, there's no way you can stop him from leaving the country in a certain sense. But hopefully then, but some of the settled already, but older maybe, works for 1 year in South Africa, and is not that young and going abroad. But I'm not sure if Dr. Mulisani wants to add. The problem at the moment, why are people struggling to get a job as a vet? So what the question is from the honourable member over there. Yeah.
And I'm going to say maybe in a way that may not be understandable on our member state. Our understanding is particularly the students when they are just about to qualify. There has always been that impression that it's not very very nice to work for the state. They always wanted to go and work in private practice to do all those operations, you know, the high-powered procedures and things like that. They always thought that state veterinary work is boring. But of course, they just do not understand the challenges of the state veterinary state. When we get new qualified veterinarians to come and work for the state, then there is that wow sort of situation where we start wondering now. You are involved in a myriad of very interesting areas and quite a number of them become interesting. best of my knowledge, the South African Police Service is only staffed by about three veterinarians, doctors, premium, and three of them, and lots of veterinarians. The research environment, including even the medical research environment, we also need lots of veterinarians, including the communicable diseases. Probably you know, honorable members, that currently our National Communicable Disease Institute is headed by veterinarians, Dr. Bobson Bull and Dr. Babeska. And that is for diseases like Ebola disease, Ebola hemorrhagic disease, which are primarily animal diseases that end up within humans and creating lots of concern when diseases are very human diseases, or honorable chair, it's an animal disease, which also causes lots of mortalities and lots of expertise within the region. So, in essence, from a point of view of community service, if this policy is approved, we are hoping to build capacity in all those areas. And then without only talking about the aquaculture, we also have a vast marine life. Animal life that also needs lots of animal support. At this moment, we don't have capacity to do that. So, we find ourselves limited only to the animals in that. So there will be potential that will keep these veterinarians employed until they find adequate employment.
Thank you, Deputy Minister, Chairperson, honourable members. With regards to ensuring that the young graduates remain in rural areas, I just want to take us back years ago. Before we had private practice in the country, services were generally provided by the state. And because of that, opportunities were created in rural areas. Then you had state vets starting to open practices in rural areas. But over years, the trend has been that you only have now most of the old vets remaining in rural areas, even as private practitioners. So what we foresee is that when you have young graduates in the state and you put them in these rural areas, you expose them to opportunities that are out there. And with time, even when they leave after the 1 year, they'll see that there are still opportunities of opening up practices in these rural areas. And that creates, through economic development of those areas, they can stay in those areas. Now, just to add with regards to the aquaculture and marine, yes, there is a shortage. But I'm aware that currently, negotiations between the faculty ownership board with Rhodes University have gone to a high level to make sure that they start bringing in training of even the undergraduates on the aquaculture aspect. So probably within the next 2-3 years, we'll start seeing even undergraduates from ownership board having the background and the knowledge on aquaculture fish disease in the country.
Thank you, sir. Can you go to the next one? It's also from Oliver Stein. It's about the appeal process, Section 12 that being amended, and specific time frames. Now, Article 3A added that said the lodger appeal in terms of Section 30A that sort of describes an appeal. But I don't know that technical detail. I'm not sure if the council can help us exactly on the appeal process or Mr. Dr. Masani.
I think the council, before they handle it, they cannot do something. Can you help us?
Thank you, honourable members and DM. The appeal process will be prescribed, so the regulations should make provision for the exact procedure that is to be followed. And that will be done once the Act gets promulgated. But we are working on the regulations at the moment. Thanks.
The next question is on waiving by the Minister. And I think that's part of what I said at the end of earlier, common sense process. This can be very negative. This is handled badly. The question of where you placement of students and how you handle it. As I said, I hope we learn from the experience on the other side. And I also hope that there's somebody with common sense applying this in a humane way, because in the end it's quite simple just to address people's problems and not to be too rigid on it all. But the Minister do have the right, does the right to waive it in a certain sense, and as I said, I hope we learn from the other side. At the end, when the regulations are clear, hopefully there will be answers, how do you handle this? Because surely there's always people with a specific problem here, maybe another year, can't do it this year, or being married, as I said, whatever. And in the end, it ought to be a happy experience, not necessarily a bad experience, because we want to play them into the profession. On the sixth question also was on the question of people not paying. And the problem is, as I understand it, and if you have children at university, you know, they don't want to confer the degree on you unless you pay whatever is owed them. I even have a problem with my children with fines because they park their car in the wrong place. Now they don't get the degree because they don't want to pay their fine. And that's the one way that university sort of forced them to do that. The problem is then the student can't start, they don't get recognition and can't start with his work. And this article is to try and solve that one, that you can start already if you have or some don't have a bursary or there is some other problem, and hopefully then can earn a salary and start paying back, and it must help to solve that problem. And at the moment, the University of Pretoria that was a consultant, and I was informed that they understand it and will cooperate, that maybe the degree is not conferred, but he does get all the academic work and is in a situation to start working, and that you can bridge the problem in that sense, and then hopefully pay back and get the final paperwork done afterwards. Dr. Mutsani, want to add, yeah.
The other part of the question was the question as to whether there aren't any barriers. Yeah. And maybe let me say, of course the department does give barriers to a limited extent. It's not everybody who is being offered barriers. I think there is, in general, a criteria that is being used by potential sponsors to look at whether the students do afford to pay or can afford to pay for the studies and so on, by looking at the earnings of the parents and things like that. Of course, there is one or two or even more situations where we can miss a needy student. And these needy students are the ones who are often subjected to the trauma of having to go through all the studies, completing, and at the end, not getting their certificate and not being employed because they don't have their certificate. So from the point of view of trying, in the first instance, I mean, if we have that kind of student who has qualified, gone through all the training, and is only sitting at home, it is a loss to the country. Maybe we can bring in an aspect that is a little controversial here. The subsidy from the studies that we have conducted, that the state pays for training of one veterinary student is between 700 and 1,000. So that is a big loss to the state in any case. If that skill is just sitting there and not coming back into the country. So I think from the thinking behind this amendment is wasteful, and then let us see how we can bring it back so that we can get at least a contribution from the students to the community. So what I'm trying to say here is, even if there isn't that buzzer, physical buzzer that is coming out, there is a subsidy that is coming out of the state. That is the point of view that we are taking.
Thank you. Now, you know, I was told that it's more expensive to train the vet than to train a medical doctor. And I think this figure was given 260 rand a year, 260,000 a year, and that calculates almost to 1.6 million. So surely that is an argument from the state's point of view to say you can't just finish your study and then leave the country to practice somewhere else. And maybe in this year can then be argued based on something that what we did for you from that side, and I think that's a good argument that can be used. Next question was also on investigations. How is it currently being done? And I think part of the frustrations is exactly that it cannot be done exactly as it ought to be done, and therefore these article sections are needed to give more power. But maybe the council can help us with how it's being done at the moment with the present act as it is.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Honourable Member, the current situation is that we depend mostly on the registrar to investigate complaints in liaison possibly with other role players, for example, the SAPS. But when coming to facilities, because we set the minimum standards, we started piloting a few years ago the identification of people within provinces and sort of nominate them as people who could look at evaluating facilities. But for us to visit those facilities and do the inspection and so forth, we depend on the member of the profession basically accepting that so-and-so can come and inspect and visit the facility. So what we're trying to do, we're trying to create a situation where the legal framework can give us the mandate and the powers to be able to do that. Thank you.
Go to the next one. That's the honourable member on English. English is not my first language. It's physiological versus psychological. Unbelievable, these English guys. They say the one physio starts with a P, the other one psycho, it also starts with a P. So I can understand the confusion, and I can understand the Afrikaans woman that said, you know, these English, they say Jerusalem, but when they start spelling it, you tell them Constantinople, you see. But I think Dr. Borisani explained it in the sense that it's trying to define what is veterinary and what's not veterinary, and therefore to keep the profession professional, because in a court case you're in trouble if somebody else did it. And that's why they added physiological in that. And then Dr. Borisani wants to add that to define the career then.
I think maybe also the council must come in here, because there were also questions as to who will do the training, and especially I think there was also a question of whether the paraveterinarians will be allowed to do this kind of service. And as I indicated, the intention really is not a turf war, it's not an intention to fight for the service that can be provided by a farmer. We understand that a good farmer can do pregnancy diagnosis. But from, I think, the current act, if the farmer does diagnose pregnancies in his own equipment, wherein there are no financial gains and so on, I don't think we have much jurisdiction over it. But if the farmer is doing a service, maybe it's wrong to refer to a farmer, even if it is not a non-farmer, doing a service to another client, therefore charging a fee and therefore issuing a certificate. It is not right, because if those animals, let's say I want to go and sell my sheep, and then I take them to the person who says that the sheep are pregnant, and then I go and sell them on the basis that they are pregnant, and I call the unborn babies or lambs, start animals, and I charge pride for that. It is not such a good service to
have a parameter there, but there's a specific person with a particular skill, the veterinary council is able to authorize that person to provide that particular service. So what we're trying to do here, we're trying to make sure that the people who are providing a service where they're diagnosing a physiological condition, there can be a way of managing and regulating those people, and in, for the sake of protecting the public. And therefore, in situations where we don't have a vet in that particular area, or we don't have an animal health technician or a veterinary nurse providing that service, but you do have a person with a particular skill, the skill will be evaluated and that person will be authorized. Now, with regards to the training, the veterinary council actually set the minimum standards, also an education. So what we will do is that we will set up the standards with regard to what kind of training such people should be should acquire in order to do that. And that we normally do in consultation with various institutions. Thank you, Chair.
The next one is also from our Spain on mentorships, and I think it's a very valid point. I don't think it's possible to write all those things in act as such, but I think you compare it to the health services, most of them are those medical doctors will be in a hospital somewhere in a rural area where there are some senior people around. Well, this situation might be different. And that point is a valid point, and I think at the end with the regulations you ought to sort of have some mentorship or some seniority to enable the student to really do his job. I'm not sure if they want to add on the other side there.
Thank you, dear Chair, honorable members. This is one of the very important points that we spend a lot of time in discussions with students, with the academics at Industrial Board, as well as the greater stakeholders. We considered two situations, and those were based on consultations. We eventually had two views, basically. There was a very strong view that wanted us within the organizational structure that we will create to manage and implement this compulsory community service to also have, let me say, appoint part-time professors and so on, such that when these community service vets are on the field, they have somebody whom they can always conduct and ask for guidance and direction and so on. And that view was mainly fueled by the fact that at the time the students viewed this compulsory community service as an extra year of in-service training sort of, and therefore they felt that they would not be comfortable being out there by themselves and so on. We considered that view, but there was another view that these graduates, they have actually completed the 6 or 7 year academic qualifications. They have been issued by the university with a confirmation that they meet the requirements of being operational as best. And therefore, if there was no compulsory community service, what were you going to do? The reality is that for those who go into state service, they will be employed there, they will be a supervisor within the line management and so on. In most of the times, you are posted in a district alone, but you have got those support structures with a supervisor and so on, that if you have got a problem, you can. If you go to a private sector, hopefully if you go to a practice where there is already an existing private practice, there could be senior doctors, veterinarians and so on, who can actually give you that guidance and support. But there is nothing allowing you actually to go all out, fresh graduate, you go and start a private practice. What were you going to do? And that you would end up really relying on all the other support of the other practices around and so on. We eventually settled on this option too, that let's recognize that these are qualified vets. If there was no compulsory community service, they will do well if they are in state with a line supervisor and that kind of network. And if they've gone to private practice, they will be having those other senior vets and so on who will do that. The reason why we settled that is quite, it sounds like a joke, honorable members, because we then talked to students, and maybe now I'm going to touch a little bit on the issue of payment, salaries and so on. When the notion of having the network of professors and actually considering the compulsory community service as an extra year of training, sort of, then it actually implies that when they do the compulsory community service, we can consider them as full vets, as a matter of fact, and therefore we are unable to get them authorized to issue escort certificates and so on and all that, and yet they have been trained fully to do that. So if you don't, if you give them minimal responsibilities, it actually implies that even when we look at are they going to be paid salaries or stipend and all that, it then meant that we will have to look at them in the direction of students, basically. Whereas we understand that they are fully trained, they are vets, and they can actually render all these services independently, and therefore they can actually be considered in terms of employment as what would you do if you are employing a young vet who has just graduated and so on. So we went on with the option two, that the existing networks, and obviously they will be increased with the number of people, but those existing line functions that currently now, if I just finished the vet education, I would be given if I was on the field. So that's where we settled, but it remained something that we really spent some time on it in order to frame it up. So we will therefore be using the people at the national departments as well as the people in the various provinces and the regions where those students are placed. Maybe with your permission, Chair, if I can just go back to the question that was raised and that was just related to that amendment in which there is a possibility that the minister may, after consultation with the council, prescribe circumstances under which certain person can be exempted. It's important for me to highlight it now so that at least we have all the same understanding. From the departmental side, what we envisaged about that clause basically was that we're not looking generally at people who are at the university and now who don't want to do the compulsory community service. Because then if all of them decide to request exemption, we will end up not having the compulsory community service. In fact, the whole compulsory becomes not compulsory anymore. They, in that category, we envisage that these would be the people who have obtained their qualification outside the Republic, who want to come to South Africa and work to South Africa, and they have experience from abroad, and maybe we want specific people to go and work in the research in the ERC and so on. So just because the law says if you are registering for the first time, do compulsory community service, we wouldn't like to do that, because then we want that pathologist, we want that virologist. So those are the kinds of people we are envisaging. In terms of final placement of people, we make it in the provision that the minister will eventually determine where people are placed. But we do envisage the exact same process as what is currently happening in the Department of Health, where people are given opportunity to have 3 to 5 choices in which they want to choose to be placed. And hopefully a person is then placed in one of those 5 choices. But we do acknowledge that this may be a little bit of a problem and a challenge, And ultimately, there could be people who will be placed where they do not necessarily want. And that's just purely the logistics. If 27 people, for example, all want to be placed in Gauteng, and in Gauteng there are only positions for 9 people, it essentially means that some of those people will eventually be placed where they do not necessarily prefer. Otherwise, if people were willing to go to these other places voluntarily, we would not have a problem that we have now where most beds are more concentrated in the rural areas. But in terms of the operational proposals, everyone will be given a choice to choose from, up to 5 choices, and hopefully you are lucky enough to be placed there. Thank you.
Yeah. That's your place,
I want to add maybe 2 things here, Chair, to the explanations given. In terms of supervision, the other wing that we are not talking much about is the private practitioners themselves. I've never seen the private practitioners so prepared to help with the aspect of supervision. All of them, every time we have meetings with them, they are asking, when are you implementing? Because they are also wanting to contribute towards the supervision as per the person. The other area, maybe not only as an anticipation to the fact that compulsory community service is going to be implemented, is the discussions that have been going between the department, the council, and the university related to the curriculum itself. Honorable members may remember that in the past, not so far past, the university had the 3 and 4, that is a 7-year program for training of the community. But in anticipation, but not only in anticipation of the institution, the university has looked at reducing the number of years to 6 years, and therefore the 7-year would be probably reviewed as that compulsory community service. But again, maybe infiltrating a little bit into the next question. It's not a stipend, but I'm not very sure whether to call it a salary yet, for now. Because when we are looking at the salary, we tend to look at other aspects of provident fund, pension fund, contribution, and of course in terms of the current structure of the public service and negotiations that have gone on, we are looking at bringing in this, can I call them qualified students, into a very advanced state of state veterinarians at level 90%. But it doesn't make financial sense to give them an
have it again. And the question that added on here, I think you answered the first part. You see the problems to balancing more or less. And there's also a question of allowances for rural areas, and I think we do accommodate that as well. The question was, do we have additional allowances for rural areas, whatever? And maybe the final from the other woman there was, is there a way to force them? Now the council can answer that one, but surely it is a sort of condition to get your registration. You are registered as a vet, but surely the council can after. If you don't want to do it, in the end, have a question mark on your further registration, but maybe the council can answer on that. But I don't know if you'll just add on the question of allowances, how do you handle that as such, and then on the fourth question, the council.
And Chair and Honourable Members, at this moment we have not been looking at rural allowance as an additional allowance per se. But of course there has been a number of issues that have been related to placement, the number of questions that have been related to placement. Some of the issues that have been raised, especially for rural areas, as issues of security and so on. And I believe that during the discussions, we will be in a position to look at all those other aspects related to the not so nice, the perceived not so nice life in the rural areas. So we don't have a full sort of response to the question of coming up with allowances. Of course, we have to be within that policy when we come up with the implementation of this particular compulsory committee. So we know that within the medical profession there is, to the best of my knowledge, there was an allowance. But the discussions around OSD is complicated matters, and I'm not sure whether the rural allowances are still in place.
Thank you. If I may, Chairman, around quite a long time, before 94, there was allowances in rural areas and in homeland areas, and I'm still in favour of that, in the sense of the allowances that I think it can be done, but I think at the moment there's a problem that it's not being done. And I think in the long run, if you talk about rural development, I'm convinced that's one way to address it. But at the moment, it's not being addressed yet. Yeah. Can I ask on the question of if they do not want to do it, how do you handle that? Yeah.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Honourable members, there are ways to try and make sure that graduates comply. And let's say, for argument's sake, you've got a new graduate within 2 months, that person decides, I'm not going to complete my compulsory community service. I want to leave the country. One way is that the minute that particular country requests a letter of good standing from the South African Council, we will refuse to issue the letter of good standing. And if that person still remains in the country and wants to continue practicing as a vet, normally as veterinarians or para-veterinary professionals, you have to maintain your registration on an annual basis. By the time comes that person has to renew the registration will not be renewed. And therefore, that person cannot practice as a veterinarian or as a para-veterinary professional. So there are ways to get people who don't want to comply. And we'll make sure that they're also thoroughly stipulated in the regulations. But I must also add that what we have started doing, I think the opportunity that for me being at the faculty as an investigator is that we're trying to inculcate
important question to ponder. One of the reasons why we're having this discussion is that veterinarians are a scarce resource, and therefore we must be mindful of how we can solve those problems at the same time that we're trying to resolve the general accessibility issue. And here one would probably be looking that vets were not included in the previous occupational specific dispensation that was handled previously, and perhaps this is an opportunity to try and have a rethink within government as to whether vets can get access to occupational specific dispensation, in that it helps to bring professionalism within the career of being a state vet, in that you have three tiers. You have the first level where vets enter, but through studying and gaining experience, they're able to progress over the years, and therefore they would get additional qualifications to deal with the fish diseases, with the bee diseases, to participate in research. And in that way, you are going to be, at the same time, building a new professional echelon of state veterinarians, which we do not have at present. And so that's the potential benefit or outcome that we can, in this process, build into this whole system. Thank you.
Thank you. If I may, I'm not sure which capacity I'm speaking now. I'll surely back that one, because I never understood why they're not part of the specific occupation. I did that make sense to me. But that was a comment as Frieda from Target leader. Can I get to the next one? And that is on the aquaculture. And I think we did address it. I was informed there's only one, as you said. And it comes more from the Rhodes University, if I'm correct. They specialize more in the well question. And surely that is a problem that we have. Need to add anything on that, you already answered that to a big extent, yeah. The question from there was on traditional leaders to take them on board. I think it's common sense that we need everybody to help us with this. It's not clear in my mind how we do that exactly without going to the specific traditional leaders on board. And that might be a problem. They believe they can start changing and having inputs or whatever, we'd be back in big trouble. But I think it will not be wrong to consult them on these things, or to try to give them an input, and maybe with the public hearings, there surely is an opportunity, if it goes to that way, for them to react to that without going to that, to their council or whatever. But I don't know if Dr. Pazani wants to add. Don't we have any additional leaders here that can add?
Thank you, DM. I'm from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. Senior State Law Advisor. The act under which we give that advice specify instances under which the bills can be referred to the House of Traditional Leadership to give inputs on that. But as you said, that we have the opinion that, for instance, this particular bill, as the Minister has said it before, that it relates to the regulation of the provision, has got nothing to do, for instance, with customary law or a custom of traditional communities. There's nothing that relates to that in terms of the bill. All that it meant, this bill is meant to regulate the profession, which is veterinary and para-veterinary profession. So in the end, we advise that it is not necessary to refer that as a requirement of that particular act. But as the Minister said, that for instance, if there's made submission in terms of the call for to submit a written submission in terms of public hearings that are forthcoming, then you might consider them. But there was no requirement to Parliament to refer it to that House for them to make an input. The other thing that I want to elaborate more is what the DMF said initially when he was taking, for instance, your question, Chairperson, in terms of the procedure that must be followed. I know that it will come, for instance, in the submission on the public hearings. People might confuse and say it's supposed to have followed Section 77 because they done that. They forget to look at the bill itself and look at the jurisprudence, for instance, the Constitutional Court jurisprudence that we have on the matter. Two cases that are prominent chairperson, you will recall the Liquor Bill that the former President Nelson Mandela take it to the Constitutional Court when he had reservation to signing the bill, and the Constitutional Court made the judgment on that. But subsequent to that, there was just last year the Tungwane bill, which they said it was unconstitutional because it followed Section 75 instead of Section 76. And in that judgment now, Chief Justice Langer made it clear as to how the taking of the bill and the classification of the bill relates to. I'll just take members so that when they consider that they do submission, they can take that into account. The DMF said, for instance, you'll see at the Schedule 4, the matters that are of national and concurrent national and provincial competency. Such matters then can follow that Section 76 bill. And you'll see Schedule 6, those are exclusive provincial competence matters. And as you can see there, you've got veterinary services, but you have a comma, excluding the regulation of the provision. So that excludes the regulation. And then if you look at the Schedule 4, I talk about Schedule 5, that's where that thing is. If you look at Schedule 4, Chairperson, that is concurrent national and provincial, you see there's no mention of a veterinary services there. So the next question that you might follow then what? Then issues that are not specifically mentioned there, it means that now the national government has what we call a residual legislative competence. That is, for instance, you'll see issues of, for instance, one of the issues that might be clear, issues of foreign affairs, for instance, or foreign relations. Those are issues of residual national competence, no provincial competency on that. So you will see at Section 76, Subsection 3, Chairperson, it tells you there that the bill must be dealt with in accordance with the procedure established in Subsection 1 or Subsection 2 if it falls within a functional area listed in Schedule 4, that I've said already, or for legislation envisaged in any of the following sections. Here are the sections. Section 65.2. Section 65.2, it deals with mandating procedures for provinces when they mandate their delegation in the National Council of Provinces. So it tells you that bill, because that section requires an Act of Parliament to be passed. So that Act of Parliament was passed and it follows the Section 76 because it falls there. Then it tells you about Section 163. Section 163, you know, it deals with the organized local government. That act when SALGA was institutionalized and all of that. Then Section 182, Chapter 182, that's another legislation that must be dealt in terms of this section, and that deals with the function of the public prosecutor. And you will know that the public prosecutor not only investigates national government, it also investigates all across all spheres, provinces. So the input of provinces might be coming to account because that might impact on their function. Then it deals with Section 6, 193, 195, 3, and 4. And that is public, the values and principles of public administration. Then 196, which is a public service, and 197, which is a public service commission, because also public service commission, public service cuts across provincial and national government. So in that judgment, that's what the Constitutional Court is saying. It says you go also beyond that, beyond looking at the debt. You go beyond looking in Schedule 5, you're in Schedule 4, which is a concurrent national and provincial competency. You go beyond those specific legislation that are required there, that must be dealt with. Then it says the bill, which is a substantial measure, that's what it's used, the concept it's used in that judgment, a bill that in a substantial measure impact on the function of the provinces, then it must be dealt with in terms of Section 76. And then it elaborates what it means. It says about the substantial measure in the same judgment. It says the more the bill impact on the capacities, powers, and capabilities of function of the provinces, then it must be dealt with in terms of Section 76 of the Constitution, this procedure that is required by Section 76. And when you look at this bill, and particularly with the Act itself, in tandem with the Act, you will see that the bill doesn't at all impact on the capacities of function of them. It only deals with the regulations of the profession. Hence, we, together with the department, we advise Parliament, because at the end of the day, it is Parliament that is the ultimate decider or arbiter as to what the procedure must be followed in terms of the bill. Hence, we've got what we call in Parliament the taking mechanism, which is the Speaker, the Deputy Speaker, the Chairperson of the National Council of Provinces, the Deputy Chairperson of the Council of Provinces, supported by the Chief Parliamentary Legal Advisor. They make a final determination as to which procedure must be followed in terms of processing the bill. And in this manner, following our advice, because they also independently scrutinize the bill, they look at our opinion that we have given them, and they took their own independence. So, okay, the bill must follow Section 75 procedure. Thank you, Chairperson.
My only comment, Deputy Minister, is that, you know, dealing with legal bodies, what we've just listened to, you know, when you watch a bioscope in the olden days, those are showing shots.
I think he did quite well. Of course, he didn't use one Latin word to hold that. Normally, they use a Latin word or two just to let us feel inferior that we don't understand, but he didn't do so. I think it helped us a lot. I do some course in that just to impress us. So the next question was, on the question of, if I listen correctly, cultural colleges and people not having degrees. And the council must help you on that one, but as far as I understand it, these are not for that. It doesn't, it's just for the profession and the veterinary profession and paraveterinary, and it doesn't have with the cultural college diplomas, for example, but maybe you can help them.
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Another members, maybe I should highlight, when we're speaking about the veterinary, we're speaking about the veterinarians, and currently in South Africa, the only institute that is recognized, where we recognize the qualification of veterinarians, because we do monitor the training, we monitor subjects, and we do the visitation once in 6 years or so. It's the University of Pretoria at Onderstepoort. When we speak about the paraveterinary professionals, we speak about the MR technicians, that's number one. And there are currently only two institutions in South Africa where we recognize the qualification. It's the Northwest University and UNISA. Then you have veterinary nurses, and there's only one institute, and that is the University of Pretoria Onderstepoort Veterinary Faculty. Then you also have what we call the veterinary technologists. Those are the people that work in the lab, veterinary labs, laboratories. And the one institute in the country where we recognize the qualification is the TAT, that is the Tshwane University of Technology. Then you have the last group, per se, that is called the laboratory animal technologists. Those are the people basically looking after the animals that are used for research, most of the time for research. And the training before was given by TAT, then it was UNISA. Unfortunately, we don't have any institute in the country that is training that group. We rely on people training overseas. And you then have the one group where we authorize. I'm sure you must have heard about what we call animal welfare assistants. These are the people normally employed by your non-governmental organizations, well, animal welfare organizations. Now, those people, we authorize them, as I said, under Section 23C. Now, our point of departure always is that any training in veterinary aspects, that training has to be set and monitored by the South African Veterinary Council. So if there's going to be any training, any institute in the country is welcome to provide training. However, we as the Veterinary Council, on behalf of the public and government,
profession of animal health technicians came on board under the Veterinary and Paraveterinary Act, we involved those institutions in looking at the training and looking at what would be required for that profession to come on board. So even up to now, we engaged them and we said to them, do a self-evaluation. This is the process that you have to follow. For us as the South African Veterinary Council, ultimately to agree in recognizing that qualification and making sure that the graduates that will come there with the training on animal health as animal health technicians will be recognized and receive automatic registration in the country. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And the last question I have from Honourable MLA was the question of how do we plan to retain skills in South Africa, and that specific, have we done a skill audit, was his question. Now, I think this whole exercise is already addressing that, trying to address that, because at the moment, I think the figure was used to, it was about that somebody said 45% of veterans that leave quite often just after. I heard the Queen's got a veteran as well, written from South Africa. I'm not sure if it's for her or for the corgis, I'm not sure what he do, or the horses maybe, but he's a South African. And in that sense, how do you address that? There's no way you can force them, but surely but what you're compulsory training is a way to force in a certain sense to say you owe us, and I mentioned the figure of 1.6 million, and hopefully afterwards we can try. In the government service, surely, with better salaries and that type of thing, but that is part of this occupational specific, to try and keep them, and we must first get over that hurdle, and we must that as far as I'm concerned. On the second one, just on the skills audit, and I'm going to give the Kosani an opportunity there, surely we know the department of the vacancy rate, and that is a big problem. And that is a sort of a skills audit to know we need so many and we only have so few. And that the post available already give us an indication that's been met at the police and all those other services. So that is a sort of a skills audit. I don't know if we get more than that, but maybe Dr. Kosani want to react to that one.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. It won't be very easy to answer this question. But also from a point of view of the questions that were tabled, for instance, there hasn't been a formal skills audit, but we have been evaluated in the past by trading partners who have indicated that we are short. We don't have enough risk analysts, for instance. We don't have fish veterinarians. We don't have bee veterinarians. I don't think we have enough public health veterinary practitioners in the country. But there is also a process that we are working from the instructions of this honorable committee for us to get evaluated independently by an organization, and maybe DM through you, I must take this opportunity to indicate that we will be undertaking that evaluation. The date that we have is on the 1st up to the 21st, 1st up to the 21st of October. The OIE will be conducting that evaluation, and then we will be in a position to know exactly the needs of the country in terms of veterinary services. But as I indicated, there are areas that we know that we are short of skills, and I mean, for a country of 50 million people, it is not very acceptable that we have only one fish specialist with so many fish resources, and then also considering the contribution that aquaculture can make towards food security, and we know that we are short of the moment. With that very vague response, I thank you very much.
If I may add, my drag as well. Dr. Morisani is the deputy president at the international body, if I'm correct. A council member, that's good enough for me. A council member on the international body, and I think that also tells something of recognition for the job he does.
Newspaper, I'm open.
Oh, no, I've seen this one from the trip.
It applies in vivo and in vitro.
There's a recording device here. That's why I can't say what I.
Yeah, am. Please ask her to forward to Barry, yeah?
Oh, okay.
Because he's dealing with it.
No, but I am happy to say,